This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 3rd, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs. Let's take a look this week at the developments. We've had quite a few happen this week. It was a rather busy week we had as Congress was rushing to get out of town, and we had a number of other developments take place during this week. In fact, we're going to start with the thing that Congress did for us here. And that is Congress actually passed a bill with tax provisions just before leaving town. It is the Transportation and Veterans Health Care Act of 2015, H.R. 3236, signed into law by the President on July 31st. This bill does a number of things, but one of the big things which it does is it changes the due dates and extension times for various tax returns, and that's going to be a major change coming up. Now, these changes will be for tax years beginning after December 31st of 2015, except for, and this is an odd but understandable exception due to budget issues, C corporations with June 30 fiscal years where the new dates will not apply for another decade. So if you have a fiscal year C corp in the back of your mind, just keep in mind that the rules for when they have to start doing things is going to be a little different than the rules for when everybody else does. So we're going to be in a little bit of a different situation. Generally, under these rules, partnerships will now file by the 15th day of the third month following the end of the fiscal year. Now, remember, this is for years beginning after December 31st of 15. So this is not next year's returns, but those you file. This is not the returns you'll file next tax season. This is the ones you're going to file in 2017 for 2016. S corporations will remain the 15th day of the third month. C's, though, will move to the 15th day of the fourth month. So we're going to move the C's back another month. The FinCEN Report 114, that is the FBAR report, will now be due on April 15th with a maximum 6 months extension. And if a taxpayer is required to file the form for the first time, the IRS will be authorized to waive any penalty for a failure to timely request or file for an extension, because the taxpayer may not discover they need to do this until their extended tax return date. The Form 3520 will be due on April 15th with a maximum extension of 6 months, as will the Form 3520A. Now, extensions will be changed. Again, Form 1065 will have a maximum 6 month extension that will end September 15th. Now we have a 5 month extension that ends September 15th, so we'll be back to the same structure, still the same date. Form 1041 will be a maximum extension of 5.5 months, which will end on September 30. So we'll have to have them done 15 days before the drop dead date for the individual returns. A Form 5500 will now have a maximum extension of 3.5 months that will end on November 15th. A Form 990 will go to an automatic 6 month extension ending on November 15th, and the Form 4760 and the Form 5227 will both get 6 month extensions, automatic extensions that will follow from the due date of the return. What Congress also added was an additional information on Form 1098. Now they will have to report the balance of the mortgage at the beginning of the year, the address of the property securing the mortgage, and the mortgage origination date. Okay, that will affect returns and statements due after December 31st of 16. And the new bill also mandates consistent basis reporting by heirs. This is effective now because it was effective for anything filed. Any 706 is filed after the effective date, filed basically, in this case, you know, after that date. So those filed August 1st and later. The 706, the executor will need to file an information return with the IRS, provide the information to the beneficiaries. If a 706 is filed, they're going to have to also have consistent reporting, so a beneficiary cannot disagree with the amount on the 706. Once the 706 has been accepted, that will bind the beneficiary as well. Next up, we have a case here, AgroGel Farming Enterprises, Inc. versus Commissioner, 145 TC number 5. Now, this particular case was decided as to whether this farmer could deduct packaging materials when they purchased them, not when it was used. They're cash basis. Farmers have traditionally been allowed to be cash basis. The IRS argued, however, that these were supplies under the supply regulations. They had to be capitalized. Now, this is all well and good, but here's the problem. The taxpayer wins. The tax court found that the taxpayer was able to deduct them when paid. But our problem is this is under Regulation 1.162-3, and the tax court spent a lot of time going through the details of that reg. That regulation changed the beginning of 2014, part of the tangible property regulations that we all had all that fun with this year. It's not totally clear how it will work because this particular farmer did GAAP basis financial statements where these packaging supplies had been capitalized, It's not clear now under the current rules they will be supplies. They will not be incidental supplies because they count them. And in this case, the de minimis election almost certainly will not help the taxpayer because they are actually capitalizing them on their financials, assuming they have applicable financials. And probably the service would argue they're capitalizing them on their books because they're actually keeping, they're preparing GAAP financials. That could get us an interesting discussion of what exactly represents the books under that reg. In any event, keep tuned, but remember, this reg, this decision depended heavily on a reg that doesn't, that currently is very different from the one that the court decided. Next up, we have an interesting issue. Marijuana keeps coming back to us because we've had all these issues happening where states are now legalizing, at least in some cases, the sale of marijuana. And at the federal level, it's still basically an illegal substance that cannot be sold legally. And in the state of Washington, we're going to take a look at Chief Counsel Advice 2015-31016. And our problem becomes Section 280 cap E of the Internal Revenue Code, which generally denies deductions to enterprises that sell things that are controlled substances federally illegally, that sell them illegally under federal law. In this case, the state of Washington imposes an excise tax on the legal sale of marijuana in the state. It is a 25% tax on wholesale transactions and a 25% tax on retail transactions, so it's not going to be a small amount of money in this case. And the question becomes, since Section 280 cap E denies deductions to those selling controlled substances for everything except a cost of sale, in essence, are the people who are selling this product going to have to essentially just absorb that double 25% whammy and have to basically fail to be able to deduct that on the return? And the answer from the IRS was a little interesting. They took a look at the detail of Section 162A of the Internal Revenue Code. And there we discovered there that any tax basically which is paid or accrued by the taxpayer in connection with the acquisition or disposition of property shall be treated as part of the cost of sales of the cost of the property or in a disposition a reduction in the amount realized. So when a seller sells the marijuana and basically gets hit with this 25% tax, the 25% tax will be deemed to be a reduction of the sales price and not deemed, therefore, to be a deduction that is denied by 280E. Rather, we're simply going to directly reduce the sales reported on the return. That's going to allow, effectively, a deduction for this amount. So this, again, is Chief Counsel Advice 2015-31016. Interesting little case. IRS this week issued a new safe harbor rule and accounting methods for ratable service contracts. Now, this is Revenue Procedure 2015-39. This revenue procedure is a safe harbor accounting method for what's described as a ratable service contract. Now, generally, this is going to affect accrual basis taxpayers. And for an accrual basis taxpayer, an expense can be taken into account when all of the following have taken place. All the events have occurred to establish a fact of a liability, basically, which is the event fixing liability takes place or payment is due. The amount of liability can be determined with reasonable accuracy. And the third test, economic performance, has occurred with respect to the liability. It is this third part of the test that this safe harbor rule is going to impact. What this is looking at is a contract in this case that is going to be for, that provides for similar services to be provided on a regular basis. They may be daily, weekly, or monthly. And each occurrence of the service is independent value. So what they give us an example is, for instance, you're paying somebody to do janitorial service in your office. So every evening they come by and they clean the office. And essentially they do that as and their individual benefits. And each service is not really linked to the last one. You could change janitors and there really be no problem day to day. You know, you have janitorial services and each service doesn't depend on the next. So that's considered to be this sort of ratable service contract. Now, what if you have that contract? That's going to be the key here. So this one is the term of the contract does not exceed 12 months and contract renewal provisions will not be considered in determining if it goes beyond 12 months. So we have a shorter than 12 months. So let's say we sign a 1-year deal for janitorial services in our office. And under the terms of the contract, we're to pay each month ahead. So at the end of December, we have now paid for January's service. Question is, can we accrue that in December? If you make this election, economic performance will be deemed to have occurred over the term of the contract. Now, generally, under the year-end rules, We can go ahead and treat economic performance as being incurred at year end if we have economic performance within 2.5 months after the end of the year. Or if we made the recurring item election, that can even stretch ourselves out if we meet the other requirements all the way back out to 8.5 months after the end of the year. Well, in this case, they're saying if you make this election, that 12-month contract, we don't need to complete the whole contract. Rather, we're going to consider each day's performance occurs by day. So we will have economic performance all the way through 2.5 months in March 15th. However, we only paid for 1 month, so we'll still be able, though, to accrue and deduct the payment for the 1 month because the terms of the contract provided that that was the only payment due at the end of December. If our contract had required quarterly payments to be made, so we had to pay the quarter up front, and we had the quarter that was due there at December 31st, then we would get it through March 15th. That would be the economic performance date. So that would be our control. Economic performance, if you make this election, will occur over the term of the contract. Now, this is a new accounting method. Because of that, if you want to use this method, you're going to need to get the IRS permission for a change. The Rev Proc 2015-39 adds a new automatic accounting method change to 2015-14's list. That does mean you'll need to file a request for a change of accounting method, and you'll need to attach that to your tax return for this year and compute a 401A adjustment for what would have been the amount that would have been different at the beginning of the year. Next up, we have the estate of Schaefer. This is 145 TC number 4. This deals with the question about how do we value the interest in a net income makeup charitable remainder unit trust. In this case, this particular charitable remainder unit trust provided for payment of the lesser of the unit trust amount or income each year. So under a charitable remainder unit trust, that's a unique situation where we have a split interest trust and the law allows us a deduction for charitable purposes. In this case, the deduction is being used for estate tax purposes, but the same basic rule applies for income tax purposes. If we have a trust that pays an income interest for life to one person and then has the remainder go to charity, and it's either a unit trust interest, which is a percent of the value of the assets at the beginning of each year, or it is an annuity interest, which is a fixed amount per year. Generally, the rules state that we can get a current deduction for the amount that would go to charity in the future, but only if at least 10% of the initial value is presumed or treated as if it was going to be received by the charity. Now, one of the other rules allows says that you can have that unit trust percentage, which this one did, and you can limit it to income. So we pay either the unit trust percentage or the trust income for the year, and we can allow for makeup in a later year if the income provision is less than unit trust, and this trust allowed for that. The question becomes, how do we value that future interest? And the tax court in this case agreed with the IRS treatment they provide in Rev Proc 2005-54. That is, you have to use the stated payout amount. We do not care about the fact that the income amount could limit it each year. You still use the stated payout amount. The catch in this case was if we use that amount, the amount deemed going to charity went below 10%. So in this case, no deduction was allowed for an amount being transferred to charity in the estate of Schaefer. Next up, Illinois Lumber and Materials Dealers Association Health Insurance Trust versus United States from the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals. This is 1116 AFTR 2nd 2015-507. And this particular case deals with the mitigation provisions that we find in Section 1311 to 1315. This particular association applied for a refund of taxes based upon the unrelated business income tax that was due to having sold shares of stock in an insurance company that they had received when that company demutualized. If you remember the Fisher case, in that case, the Court of Claims, later sustained by the Federal Circuit, took the position that the IRS argument that the basis of such shares was zero simply didn't hold up. Now, in this case, the association filed for 3 different years where they had these sales. The problem was the first year, we were past the 3-year period for filing for a claim for refund when they finally said, hey, the Fisher case came down, we want to try to go get our money. They argued that because the IRS in 2 later years allowed the higher basis, that the mitigation rules of 1311 to 1315 should apply in this case, and they should be able to take a deduction that, in essence, that should allow them to reopen the statute. The district court agreed with that, but the Eighth Circuit overturned it on appeal. Now, the Eighth Circuit admits those mitigation provisions are, shall we say, at best confusing. The court even calls them poorly written. And the court also points out that it gets complicated and the court cases are sometimes almost impossible to reconcile with when it happens. But in this case, they found the IRS had never made a holding on the early year, the 2004 year, which was the one they were denying. They never made a holding that was inconsistent. They simply conceded or basically gave into, you know, the court case in later years. They had not relied upon it. Nothing prevented the taxpayer from essentially applying in the earlier years to have asked for a refund on those taxes. The fact that they didn't, as the court said, we don't reawaken the sleeping dog, that is the statute of limitations, by allowing them to later on with later court cases go back and reopen every year if it turns out there's finally a court case that suggested, hey, the position we took earlier doesn't quite work. Without inconsistent holding, we simply don't have an issue to work with here, and that was the position of the court in this case. Next up, we've got the IRS coming back and requesting comments on the Cadillac tax again. You may remember back in January, and it was 2015-16, the IRS put out a notice about some proposed areas they're going to deal with the Cadillac tax on high-cost plans that will take effect here in the future. Now, 2015-52, we start again looking at this issue of the Cadillac tax, and the IRS is asking for more guidance. This Cadillac tax will take effect for taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2017, so effectively we're talking about year 2018. What the IRS did at this point was they came out first and asked for comments on the treatment of items for the Cadillac tax. Now they've added to the list of proposed issues they're dealing with, most likely, presumably, because they got some comments about questions in other areas, so they've added new questions or new items. And so they're asking for comments. The areas they talk about here include, you know, who will be the taxpayer liable to pay the tax? And remember, these are on high cost. If a plan costs too much, you have to pay an additional tax when you offer that plan if you're the provider. The idea is effectively to make these plans unaffordable. But still, some people will come in close, or at least some portion goes over, so we'll have to do it. We'll talk about when we aggregate employers for purposes of this tax. We'll talk about issues about age and gender adjustment. And then there are a number of other issues that will come into this area. So we're going to talk about those. If you're involved in this and you believe you have an issue with a high-cost plan, you want to take a look at 2015-52 and 2015-16. In addition for asking for comments, these proposals, these notices, also tell us what the service is thinking of doing in this area. And that may be helpful for you in planning as we come forward to 2018 with the Cadillac tax, assuming the Cadillac tax stays around for that long. Now let's take a look at, finally, a case that probably is going to cause more confusion than be helpful, but nevertheless, we've got it. We have now officially got a split in the circuits regarding whether a taxpayer must be in on a fraudulent return filing for the IRS to have an open statute under the fraud provisions. Generally, the IRS has 3 years to assess tax against a taxpayer unless the return was fraudulent. The case we're going to look at today is BASR Partnerships versus United States. This particular case that was decided that comes up to us from the Federal Circuit, this case takes a look and talks to us about basically this issue of whether there's a fraudulent return. In this case, the partnership, there's no question that the partnership return, you know, the partners, shall we say, the partnership, the promoter of the partnership, an attorney involved with this, we're going to accept the fact, it's conceded by the parties in the case, so we're just going to take as a fact that this person had fraudulent intent. He intended to have people evade tax. However, there's not evidence that the actual partner here understood that this was fraudulent. They believed it was a legitimate tax planning issue. Now the question becomes, does the fact that there was fraudulent intent on the part of the promoter mean that the return, and you know, therefore creating a fraudulent return, does the fact the taxpayer wasn't aware the return was fraudulent, does that protect them from the IRS being able to assess based on fraud? We have a couple of cases in this area where the courts have ruled that no, sorry, taxpayer, you don't have to know anything about it, you can still be held liable. The first, the big case that came up at first was the Allen case, 128 TC number 4. That was a taxpayer who had the return prepared by a preparer that was engaged in basically preparing fraudulent returns and getting big refunds. The taxpayer wasn't aware of what the preparer did, didn't understand the return. It was irrelevant. The tax court held that because the return was fraudulent, that's the only test we've got to meet. In the case of Citywide Transit, which is a Second Circuit case, the Second Circuit held that in that case, a payroll service had been preparing fraudulent 941s where they'd claimed that there was essentially an early payment of the earned income credit back when, we had that, the employers did that, which offset all the taxes that should have been paid. And what that payroll service was doing was that service was taking the money from Citywide's account, pocketing it, giving Citywide 941 showing the taxes as paid, but then filing returns with the IRS that showed no liability was due. When that came unraveled, the question was, could the IRS go back after Citywide for more than 3 years? The Second Circuit said that basically the key issue here was those 941s were fraudulent. The fact that Citywide didn't know they were fraudulent, in fact, didn't even know those returns had been the ones that were filed, was irrelevant. There was still a fraudulent return. Now we come up with BASR Partnership. BASR Partnership, the Federal Court of Claims, had disagreed with the tax court in the Second Circuit, stating that the taxpayer had to be in on the fraud. In this case, the Federal Circuit did sustain the ruling of the lower court, but we have a problem. It is a split decision. So we have a 2-1 split decision. Well, that might not be so bad, except it turns out that the two judges that voted to sustain the Court of Claims didn't agree among themselves about why to sustain it. One judge agreed with the Court of Claims that the taxpayer had to have fraudulent intent. The other judge claimed that it was actually decided on the wrong section, that because this involved a partnership, 6229 should have been in play. 6229 has different language and a different test, and he claims because it didn't meet that test, the statute wasn't open. But he never got to whether or not the taxpayer needed to have fraudulent intent under 6501, holding that was irrelevant because a partnership was involved in this case. And the dissent, of course, agreed with the Second Circuit and the tax court, holding that the only question was the return fraudulent? So unfortunately, as it stands at this point, we still right now have basically the Second Circuit and the tax court holding that if the return's fraudulent, the statute stays open. And effectively, it's not clear what the Federal Circuit just told us about their position, except that it's likely the Court of Claims will still take the position it did before, but whether that'll be sustained on appeal, the Federal Circuit is open, and given as fractured as this ruling is, it might be interesting to see if the IRS asks for a rehearing from the whole circuit, from the whole panel, trying to straighten out what right now is very difficult to understand, three different opinions that all come to effectively three different conclusions. Two of them, though, just come to the same result. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 3rd, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments, as I've noted, is brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP and your state society of CPAs. Be sure to visit us online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. There I'll have write-ups about this case, these cases this week, more information and links to the actual case materials. Also have a write-up on the 482, Section 42 case that came down this week, which was interesting, but I had to make some cuts somewhere, so if you want to take a look at that, that held that, in fact, we did not have to count stock compensation in a cost-sharing arrangement under 42, that regulation was invalid. So if that's important to you, you want to go to the website and read that. Also, visit the website to find updates during the week. And be sure to come back next week, and we'll talk to you about the new developments in the coming weeks in the area of federal taxes.